6. A Peaceful Existence. Gleb Nerzhin was the same age as Priyanchikov, but looked older. His auburn hair, parted in the middle, was still thick, but there were crow's feet around his eyes, little wrinkles around his mouth, and furrows across his brow. His skin was affected by the lack of fresh air, and his face had a wilted look. But what above all made him seem older was the economy of his movements, that economy by which nature conserves the flagging strength of prisoners in the camp. In the Sharashka, with meat on the menu and work that overstrained no one's muscles, Nerzhin, with the length of his sentence in mind, was nonetheless trying to make a habit of minimal movement. At present, Nerzhin's desk was barricaded with piles of books and files, and the working space in between had also been taken over by files, typescripts, books and journals, Russian and foreign, all left open. Any unsuspecting outsider would have seen the stillness after a hurricane of scientific thought. But it was all camouflage. Nerzhin always put up a front in the evening in case one of the bosses looked in. In fact, he had no eyes for anything before him. He had pulled back the light silk curtain and was staring through the dark window pane. In the depths of the vast night, big patches of light marked the outskirts of Moscow, and from the city itself, hidden behind a hill, rose an immense haze of diffused pale light, which gave the sky above it a dull reddish glow. Nerzhin's special chair, with its flexible back, his roll-top desk, something not made in the Soviet Union, and his comfortable place by the south window, would have revealed him to anyone familiar with the history of the Marfino Sharashka as one of its founding members. The Sharashka had taken its name from what had once been the village of Marfino, but was now territory within the city limits. The Sharashka had been inaugurated some 3 years ago, on a July evening. A dozen or so Zeks, summoned from the camps, were driven to what had once been a seminary just outside Moscow. The building had been fenced around with barbed wire in readiness. That was remembered as an idyllic age. You could switch on the BBC loud in the prisoners' living quarters. No one yet knew how to jam it. You could stroll about the zone in the evening without asking permission. You could lie in the dewy grass left uncut, contrary to regulations. It is supposed to be cropped close, so that you cannot crawl through it to the wire. And you could observe the eternal stars, or the perishable Sergeant Major Zhvakun on night duty, and all in a sweat, steal timber from a building under repair, and slide it under the barbed wire to take home for firewood. The Sharashka did not yet know what direction its research was to take, and occupied itself unpacking numerous crates, 3 trainloads of them from Germany, staking claims to comfortable German chairs and desks, and sorting out equipment for telecommunications, ultra-shortwave radio, and acoustics. Much of it was obsolete or had been damaged in transit. And the Sharashka gradually realized that the Germans had purloined or destroyed the best of the equipment, and the most recent documentation, while the MVD captain sent to relocate the Lawrence factory, an expert on furniture but not on radio or the German language, spent his time in and around Berlin searching out elegant pieces for his own Moscow apartment and those of his superiors. The grass had been mowed long ago, the doors now opened for the prisoners to take exercise only when a bell rang, and the Sharashka, transformed from Beria's to Abakumov's jurisdiction, had been put to work on scrambler telephones. They had hoped to complete the assignment within a year, but it had dragged on for 2 years, expanding and becoming more and more complicated as new lines of inquiry multiplied. On Rubin's and Nezhin's desks, it had reduced itself to the problem of identifying voices on the telephone, which meant determining what makes a person's voice unique. Apparently no one had done anything of the sort before. At any rate, they had come across no relevant published work. They had been given 6 months to complete their task, then another 6, but they had still made little progress, and the deadline was alarmingly close. Uncomfortably aware as he was of this pressure, Rubin nonetheless grumbled over his shoulder, "I somehow don't feel a bit like working today." "You amaze me," Nerzhin retorted. "A mere 4 years at the front and not quite 5 in jail, am I right? And already you're tired. Better put in for a Crimean rest cure." They were silent for a while.
"Working on your own thing, aren't you?"
Rubin asked quietly. "Uh-huh.
So who's going to work on the voices?
To tell the truth, I was counting on you.
What a coincidence. I was counting on you.
You have no conscience. How many books have you checked out of the Lenin Library, supposedly for this job? Speeches of famous lawyers, Connie's memoirs, improve your acting. And to crown it all, you brazenly called for a work on Princess Turandot. Can any other Zek in the Gulag boast of such a varied collection of books? Rubin's thick lips protruded, which always made him look stupid.
Strange. With whom did I read all those books during working hours, including the one about Princess Turandot? Could it have been you?
Well, I do want to work. I could lose myself completely in my work today, but for two little things. Number one, I'm agonizing over the parquet floors question.
What parquet floors?
In the MVD house on Kalushskaya Zastava, the semicircular building with the tower. Our camp helped build it in 45, and I was employed as a parquet floor layer's apprentice. I learned today that Reutemann happens to live in that very house, and I began to feel an artist's pangs of conscience, or maybe I'm just worried about my reputation. What I wonder is whether my floorboards creak or not. If they do, it may mean that I did a slovenly job, and I'm powerless to put it right.
You know, that would make a good play.
For a socialist realist playwright. The second thing is, isn't it infuriating to be working on Saturday evening when you know that only the free employees get Sunday off? Rubin sighed.
The frees have already peeled off to various places of entertainment, making pigs of themselves.
But do they choose the right places of entertainment? Do they get more out of life than we do? That's a moot point. Prisoners of necessity learned to talk quietly, and even Serafima Vitalievna, sitting opposite Nerzhin, was not supposed to hear them. They had both turned their backs to the room and sat facing the window, the lights in the prison grounds, the guard tower dimly discernible in the darkness, scattered lights in distant greenhouses, and the whitish haze over Moscow. Nerzhin was a mathematician, but no stranger to linguistics, and ever since the phonology of Russian speech had become the subject of the Marfino Sharaska's research, he had been paired with Rubin, the only linguist in the place. For 2 years they had sat together, back to back, 12 hours a day. They had discovered at once that they had both fought at the same time, first on the Northwestern Front, then on the Belorussian Front. Both possessed the Gentleman's Junior Medal set. Both had been arrested in the same month by the very same Smirsch. Both of them had been charged under the universally popular Point 10, and both had been given a tenner, not that this made them different from anyone else. There was a slight age difference, 6 years, and Nerzhin, a captain, was one step lower in rank. Rubin was favorably disposed to Nerzhin because he had not been jailed as a former prisoner of war, and so was not infected with the anti-Soviet spirit of abroad. Nerzhin was one of us, a Soviet man, only he had spent his whole youth poring over books, reading himself silly, and had got it into his muddled head that Stalin had distorted Leninism. No sooner had Nerzhin recorded this conclusion on a scrap of paper than he was arrested. Shell-shocked by jail and labor camp, Nerzhin had nonetheless remained at bottom one of us. And so Rubin had the patience to listen to the confused and nonsensical thoughts that were all he had for the time being. They looked out into the darkness again. Rubin made an impatient noise.
You really are an intellectual pauper. It worries me.
I'm not competing. There's a lot of cleverness in the world, but not much goodness.
Well, here's a good book for you. Read it.
Another one about the poor bamboozled bulls?
No.
About stalking lions, then?
Certainly not. I can't make sense of people. What do I want with bulls? You have to read it.
I don't have to do anything. For anybody. For you or anybody else. Duties duly discharged, as Spiridon says.
You pathetic person. It's one of the best books of the 20th century.
And will it really tell me what we all need to know? Where humanity went wrong?
He's a clever, good-hearted, infinitely honest writer. Soldier, hunter, fisherman, drunk, womanizer, coolly and sincerely contemptuous of all that's false. A stickler for simplicity, utterly humane, with the naivete of genius. Spare me the rest,
Nelson said with a laugh.
You'll give me an earache with your spiel. I've lived for 30 years without Hemingway, and I expect to go on a bit longer. My life's in tatters anyway. I need to limit myself, find my own way.
He turned back toward his own desk. Reuben sighed. He still did not feel like working. He began studying a map of China propped up against a shelf at the back of his desk. He had cut this map out of a newspaper and pasted it onto a piece of cardboard. Throughout the past year, he had marked with a red pencil the advance of the communist forces, and now that their victory was complete, he kept the map upright before him to cheer him at moments of weariness and depression. But today Reuben was in the grip of a sadness so acute that not even the enormous red expanse of victorious China could overcome it. Meanwhile, Nelson, pausing now and then for a thoughtful suck at the sharp tip of his plastic pen, was writing, in a script so minute that it looked more like the work of a needle, on a tiny page lost in the camouflaging billows of learned paper. The history of 1917 holds no surprises for a mathematician. A tangent soaring at 90 degrees toward infinity at once plunges into the abyss of minus infinity. In the same way, Russia, taking off for the first time toward a freedom never before seen, immediately came to an abrupt stop and plunged into the worst of tyrannies. No one has ever managed it at the first attempt. The big room of the acoustics laboratory was living its peaceful everyday life. The electrician fitter's little engine hummed. Orders were shouted. Switch on! Switch off! The radio was dishing out the usual sentimental pap. Somebody loudly demanded a 6K7 valve. Taking advantage of moments when no one could see her, Serafima Vitalievna looked intently at Nerzhin, who was still covering his scrap of paper with writing like tiny embroidery. Major Shikin, the security officer, had instructed her to keep an eye on this prisoner.